Our first case this morning is United States v. Collins, case 11-1954. Mr. Stenches?
Yes.
Good morning, Your Honors. As you correctly just pronounced, my last name is Stenches. First name is Robert, and I represent appellant Michael V. Collins in this matter. This matter stems from a criminal case that occurred down in the Southern District of Illinois. It was conducted about a year ago. During that trial, my client, Mr. Collins, was convicted of three separate charges. First charge being tax evasion under Section 7201 of the Internal Revenue Code. He was also convicted of the lesser misdemeanor charge of willful failure to file a tax return, and then a separate charge for election fraud. There was a sentencing proceeding that was conducted, and Mr. Collins was sentenced to a term of 50 months of incarceration. My client, Mr. Collins, is currently serving that incarceration in a federal penitentiary. Now, for purposes of this appeal, I've raised six separate issues which are set forth in my brief. However, with the court's indulgence, I'd like to go out of order today and instead address those issues in the order that I think is important based on the limited time that we have here today to speak about these issues. I would like to start with what was labeled issue number 5 in my appellant brief. This was the issue relating to the sentencing and specifically to the 50 months of punishment that was given to Mr. Collins. Although he was convicted of three separate charges in this case, really only one of these charges made a difference for purposes of sentencing, and that would be the tax evasion charge under Section 7201. The probation office prepared a PSIR for the court, and the court largely adopted the findings of that PSIR with only some very small deviations. In particular, the court found a tax loss of approximately $390,000. That was found over our objection. My client, the appellant, presented evidence to show that the tax loss was actually less than $200,000. So we maintain that the sentencing guideline range that was used by the federal district court was improper. They used the guideline range of $200,000 to $400,000, when in fact the tax loss was less than $200,000. This issue can be further divided into two separate issues based on years. There's an issue with respect to the years 2002 through 2004 with respect to how the PSIR and the court calculated tax loss, and then another issue with respect to 2005. There was an expert witness who testified during the sentencing proceeding. This was an accountant by the name of Nancy Noonan. She was retained by myself on behalf of my client, and she prepared a tax return She prepared calculations for the years 2002 through 2004. The court used a method for determining tax loss for the years 2002 through 2004, which is a default method. It's found in Sentencing Guideline 2T1.1. And that default method basically says if there is not a more accurate method, then the court can use or may use the calculation of gross income times 20%. And that's exactly what the court did with respect to these years 2002 through 2004. And we're not contesting that that was the proper method for those particular years. Instead, what we're contesting is the PSIR and the court's calculation of gross income. Now, I can go even farther. The parties are in complete agreement as to how that gross income, at least preliminarily, can be decided. In the PSIR, the probation office took the bank accounts of Mr. Collins that were available for these years, 2002 through 2004, and added up all of the deposits to his account. And again, all the parties are on the same page at this point. Now, the PSIR and the federal district court stopped at that level. They took that number, the gross receipts, the gross deposits to the bank account, times 20% to determine tax loss. What Ms. Noonan did, the expert witness did, was she went one step further. She looked at the deposits to that account and determined what deposits are taxable versus non-taxable deposits. For example, if a defendant were to transfer funds between one of his bank accounts into another bank account, that would be a non-taxable deposit.
If I could just cut to the chase here for a second, the expert's testimony was rejected, as I understand it. Your expert's testimony was rejected because of the premises upon which it was based, which is to say stuff that your client testified to that the court rejected as not credible. And that's ordinarily a determination that we give substantial deference to. Have I mischaracterized the situation?
Well, let me expand on it a little bit. What the court has done, really, I'll get very specific to the point. The question is whether deposits of cash to this bank account should be treated as taxable deposits or non-taxable deposits. That's really the only issue for 2002 through 2004. Now, the government has not presented any theory or any evidence as to where this cash came from. Instead, the testimony of the special agent specifically is that he found cash withdrawals from this account of over hundreds of thousands of dollars, and withdrawals from ATM cards of hundreds of thousands of dollars. And then during the same years, we have much smaller deposits of cash back to this bank account. Well, the obvious logical inference is that he's taking out cash from the bank account and then putting some back in, the unused portion. That's a non-taxable deposit. The finding of the trial court was simply
that the funds were hopelessly commingled.
Well, but break that down even farther. There has to be a source of the cash. I mean, if someone is paid, for example, the sale of drugs, if they're paid in cash, that's obviously taxable income. But in this case, there's no theory that he was somehow earning illegal income that way. Instead, the only source of cash is these withdrawals from the same bank account.
You see me, they're counting the same money twice?
Yes, they are. They count it once when it goes in.
Didn't Ms. Newton say that the accounting, the documents that she had to go through were very limited and difficult, and that it was a hard thing to even calculate based on the information she had?
Well, what Ms. Noonan had was the bank accounts, and these were not records produced by my client. These
were
records
limited.
That came from the bank.
They were partial accounts, and there were a lot of things missing, as I recall her testimony.
Well, that Your Honor, with all due respect, that really is a red herring, because it's the same numbers that the government is using in their calculation. So if they want to attack our use of their numbers, they're attacking their own calculation, not ours. Mm-hmm. We're looking at the exact same set of bank records. And they're counting all the deposits to that account, and so are we. We then back out the cash deposits. That's the only difference. This issue for these years is that isolated. It's that simple. And the government has the burden of proof based on a preponderance of the evidence. They have to show where this cash came from. If this is taxable money, they have to show where it came from. They have not done that. They haven't even attempted to do that. In fact, their testimony is the exact opposite, that there was a large amount of cash withdrawals here.
Well, of course, his failure to file didn't help any.
That's, of course, why we're here. But yet, we need to come up with an accurate tax calculation, and that's exactly what Ms. Noonan did. Now, Ms. Noonan took her numbers, she took the numbers given to her by the U.S. government, backed out a few of the deposits, which were clearly non-taxable, and then came up with the number of tax loss for these particular years, 2002 through 2004. Her method is not very far or much different than the government's. It's just a matter of a couple deposits amounting to, I think, maybe $30,000, $40,000, which she has backed out and has said these are not included in gross income.
What was the length of the sentence for the tax evasion? I forget.
50 months.
50 months. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Now, the second issue, or the second sub-issue with respect to this calculation of tax loss, is with respect to the year 2005. The PSIR and the court again used the same default method under 2T1.1, which is gross income times 20%. Now, the courts and the sentencing guidelines themselves specifically say this method is only used if a more accurate method is unavailable. Now, for the year 2005, there is a more accurate method than this default method. Now, Ms. Noonan, for the year 2005, again, obtained the bank statements and the copies of checks that were written on that account. And from those items, she did a bank deposit method, which ironically is the method that is set forth in the Internal Revenue Manual as the preferred method to use in these types of cases. And using these bank records, she was able to determine what would be, number one, gross income for 2005, and number two, what would be deductible expenses. Now, based on the face of those checks, she could tell when a certain check was a business check and when a certain check was a personal check. And she was able to create a general ledger, and from that, a tax return for the year 2005, which was presented at sentencing. Now, the court, the reasoning for not using her tax return was essentially to say that, number one, Ms. Noonan had to rely on, at least on some occasions, on my client, Mr. Collins, to identify certain items. For example, 90% of the checks were, you could tell from the face, if something was written to a construction-type expense, she could tell that was a business expense. She could also tell things that are typically personal expenses, grocery stores, clothing stores, for example, and she would treat those as personal. But on a few very limited occasions, she went to Mr. Collins and said, on the face of this check, I can't tell whether this is deductible or it's personal. So there was a very few isolated occasions where she did that. But what she actually did was to go one step farther than what normally occurs using the bank deposit method. And I cited for you in my brief the Internal Revenue Manual, where it instructs special agents on what to do in these types of situations. The Internal Revenue Manual would say, when in doubt, give the benefit of the deduction to the defendant. She went one step farther. She went to the defendant and tried to isolate even farther what was personal and what was business expense. So any reason for the government to attack Ms. Noonan based on that extra step she performed is really nonsensical, because she's just simply going that much above and beyond what even they would require of their special agents to do. So using her tax return, she's using a higher percentage as far as a tax percentage. The federal income, the code provides percentage breakdowns as high as 35% for individuals. So she's using a higher percentage rate, but she's giving Mr. Collins the benefit of the deductions to which he's entitled. He happens to be in a business which has very high costs and a very small profit margin. So in this particular type of business, his construction business, he's going to have a large amount of gross income, but a large amount of expenses to go with it. By using this default method, we're, of course, not giving him the benefit of all of his expenses. That's the only difference. Ms. Noonan is going through his bank account for 2005, where everyone's in agreement. All the records are available for 2005. The entire bank account records are available. We have every check, every deposit to that account. And she's preparing an accurate tax return based upon those records. That's exactly what an accountant would do in any office. If you walked in and said, I have an individual who hasn't kept accurate records, but I have to file a tax return, they would do the bank deposit analysis, and that's exactly what she did here. Now, that, again, I started with the fifth issue in my memorandum. The next item of importance, which I'd like to go to, would be issue number four, which is specifically the jury instruction that was given with respect to the election fraud counts. The trial court refused defendants' jury instructions, which attempted to incorporate the language from Illinois case law, state case law, regarding what is someone's residence for voting purposes. We're in agreement that state law controls voting residence for purposes of this particular criminal statute. In particular, defendants cited to a case called Baumgartner. And later on, there was a case that came out of the Supreme Court of Illinois called Maxim. And in both of these cases, there is a wonderful analysis of what constitutes a voter residence versus a temporary living quarters. The problem that existed in this case is at trial, the government went to great lengths to prove that Mr. Collins, during the years at issue, was living at the Redfield address that's cited in the briefs. And we're not contesting the fact that during these years he was living there. But the question is, where was his permanent residence for voting purposes? The jury was not given the benefit of instructions that clearly defined what is a temporary living quarters versus a voting residence. There's no doubt in this case that the residence that Michael Collins used for voting purposes is the house where he grew up, his family home. He grew up there as a child. His parents owned it. That house is still owned by his family. And then during the year 2004, he obtained a home at another address, at a Redfield address, in the same county, but not in the same voting district. So I want to make sure I'm citing these addresses correctly, because I think I just made a mistake. The address he claimed was on an address called Loisel. The address that the government is alleging he lived at was on a street called Redfield.
And the evidence of abandonment was abundant here, as I understand the record. So why does this make any difference?
Well, I would maintain that it was not abandoned. The testimony...
No, that's a jury argument. And that was rejected.
The jury should have been instructed that abandonment was one of the issues. That was the key language that was left out of the jury instruction, that they did not have to find
I'm
abandonment.
I'm asking, why does this make any difference? Because the evidence in this case, even assuming that the jury should have received an instruction based on the Maxim case, probably better known as the Rahm Emanuel case, even assuming that the jury should have been instructed on those specific points of law, why does it make any difference here? Because the evidence of abandonment was overwhelming.
Well, Your Honor's obviously come to that conclusion. I think there are plenty of facts that said it wasn't abandoned. And really the threshold of the question in this case is, when you say abandonment, let's define what that entails. It's not just the mere fact of moving out into another residence. It's much more complicated than that. I can move to a different living quarters and live there for 8 years as long as I have the intention of returning to my previous location as my permanent residence. And, in fact, the language in the Baumgartner case is actually much more loose than just simply abandonment. It's the specific language in the Baumgartner opinion is, when a person has one residence, moves into another living quarters, he essentially has the right to choose which one to use as his voting residence. And that choice language is in that Baumgartner opinion. Now, the other equation, or the other part of this equation, is in addition to simply looking at the abandonment issue, you have to look at the fact that this issue was so complicated and complex that the Illinois Supreme Court found the need to address this for purposes of...
I don't think it was that complex. The Illinois Supreme Court said that the law had been resolved long before the Intermediate Court of Appeals had attempted to change it in adjudicating the challenge to Rahm Emanuel's candidacy. That's why the opinion was so long, because the state Supreme Court was at pains to explain why the law was so clear and why the intermediate appellate court had made a mistake and was unjustified in attempting to change it, not because this is a highly complicated area of the law.
Okay. Well, the jury instruction language that we proposed was language straight out of the Baumgartner opinion. We were not making anything up. It was straight from the appellate court decision. And I'll reserve my time.
Thank you. Mr. Smith.
Good morning. May it please the court. The first issue, I can handle all of them very quickly, I guess reserving the most time for the voting issue. But the first issue is, did the jury instructions on tax evasion, taken as a whole, fairly apprise the jury of the issues? A Seventh Circuit instruction was given. The defendant asked for a negligence instruction. The Seventh Circuit instruction has a lot of language that is the antithesis, if you will, of what negligence is. It means willfully, means the voluntary and intentional violation of a known legal duty with the specific intent to avoid paying a tax. So clearly the standard Seventh Circuit pattern instruction adequately advised the jury, and further that's at record 40-1, page 28. Also at record 40-1, page 42, the jury was also given the instruction, a defendant does not act willfully if he believes in good faith. That also goes against the whole negligence theory. And the only evidence, if you will scan the entire record, of there being any theory that this particular defendant, Michael Collins, acted negligently, was questions from defense counsel that a delinquency assessment on an uncharged tax year of year 2000 was labeled as a negligence penalty for civil tax purposes. That's it in the record. There really wasn't any theory of defense. The second issue, was there sufficient evidence presented at trial to support the jury's findings as to affirmative acts of evasion? Failure to file plus affirmative acts. You can take the failure to file in looking at the intent of an individual, however, so that lawful acts can be considered as affirmative acts. And in this particular case, at the time IRS came knocking on his door, he had not filed a federal income tax return for some 13 years and, in fact, had never, ever filed a Illinois state tax return until actually after he was under indictment.
Plus, we've got the false employer identification number, the false Social Security number, or borrowed Social Security number, and the commingling of funds. So it seems to me you've got that issue nailed. Maybe you want to move to the next one.
Cites from the record actually came up with 11 different affirmative acts with cites in the record, should you want them. The next issue, whether sufficient evidence was presented at trial to support the elements of voter fraud on counts 8 and 9, and to make a correction from appellant counsel, he said that actually there are three separate charges. Actually, there are eight, you'll note in the record, three for tax evasion, three for failure to file, and three for the vote fraud. So, in fact, there's eight, not three.
But the government is conceding that the definition of residency in state law controls for purposes of the federal offense?
For purposes of whether he was eligible to vote, I am conceding that state law applies. Now, that's different than what is the appropriate jury instruction for purposes of a federal charge for vote fraud.
Right. That's what I'm trying to isolate here, what the government's position precisely is insofar as the influence of state law on this case.
Your Honor, it's state law does control as to whether he's allowed and properly goes into the polls. It's actually 10 ILCS 5/3-1. Every person who has resided in the state and in the election district 30 days next preceding the election therein.
Right, but what's the interplay between that state law requirement and a violation of the federal statute?
Well, under 42 U.S.C. 1973 I.C., Your Honor, if he willfully or knowingly gave false information as to his address or his period of residence for the purpose of establishing his eligibility to vote. So that's the interplay.
Well, that doesn't really answer the question. That's just a statement of the elements of the offense.
Yeah, I'm not sure I understand specifically what you're getting at.
Okay. Illinois state law bears on which element of the federal offense, the mens rea element, the eligibility element?
Now I understand. Thank you. It only bears on whether he gave false information knowingly and willfully. So the mental state clearly comes from federal law. But the extent of whether it's false or not, whether he was eligible to vote or not, I believe, is derived from state law. Now, whether he had the intent to provide a false address, that's clearly federal law. That makes sense? I think what's interesting in this particular case is, and there was testimony from the East St. Louis Board of Elections at trial, and there's also a Illinois Administrative Code on it, that if somebody moves and does not notify the election board within 30 days of an election, they can still go back to their prior residence and vote. But the evidence was in the law is that you can only vote a partial ballot. And I think that was relevant in this particular case because each time he went in, he voted a full ballot.
A partial ballot meaning you can vote for the state offices but not the federal offices?
It's actually quite the opposite. You can only vote for federal offices and you can't vote for the state offices because that's tied to the particular election district where you've moved from.
Okay.
Well, he was the main problem, I guess, is that he was a precinct committeeman, was it?
And in fact, that was his power base where he got his contracts with the City of East St. Louis and East St. Louis Housing Authority.
That's an amazing power base, but I guess if that's what it is, it's fine. But,
well, it's unique to East
St. You're supposed to live in the precinct when you're precinct committeeman, is that?
And that's according to Illinois state law, yes.
Yeah, so that's one thing that he did not live there, obviously.
That's correct.
And I guess that circles around the difference between a voter residence and where you live. I don't know how that combines with the federal violation, or if the failure to live in what the district you're supposed to represent,
well, I can tell
precinct.
Your Honor, that the false petition, if you will, for being a precinct committeeman,
mm-hmm.
That was purely a state violation. So the only federal violation we had on the vote fraud was when he personally went in and voted in an election that had a federal candidate on the ballot.
I see.
But in this particular case, I believe what we established that's throughout the record is physical presence was not ever really maintained, and it was a complete fiction. It is correct he was born in East St. Louis, and by the time of trial, we had a 49-year-old individual who had previously been married, had a 25-year-old son, had a girlfriend, then had a 14-year-old daughter. They were living in what, by Belleville standards, is somewhat of a semi-mansion, a very nice $274,000 house with a 30-year mortgage. Contrast that with the place he was born in, that there's really no indication he ever really lived there, apart from his comments for decades. And it's a two-bedroom dilapidated house that we established that actually by early 2007, his sister filed a TIF application with the City of East St. Louis because she was the actual owner and indicated that the roof was leaking and it had collapsed sewer lines.
She was the owner and she was paying property tax?
Correct.
So he wasn't doing anything then?
No, he was not the owner. And in fact, evidence was presented at trial that was seized in a search warrant at his Belleville address that he was contesting a phone bill from the East St. Louis address, and he indicated that he never, ever had phone service at that East St. Louis address. So I believe sufficient evidence was established that he never had the true physical presence at the East St. Louis address, and it was purely a fiction for work and for political purposes. Therefore, the instructions, if we go to kind of segue into element four, I think it's interesting to note that appellant did not object to the government's instruction. A person is eligible to vote at the polling place for the precinct where they reside. Two elements are necessary to create a residence for voter registration purposes: physical presence and an intent to remain there as a permanent resident. I believe because the jury was required to find that he had the intent to remain there as a permanent resident, that really is the inverse of abandonment anyway. You can't intend to remain somewhere as a permanent residence if you hadn't already left, or abandoned, or never lived at a prior address.
Your argument is that abandonment, which is what the Maxim case talks about, based on prior state court case law, is implicit in the instruction that was given about intent to remain permanently.
A couple of points on that. I think the jury instructions taken as a whole for this particular case, I am taking that position. Maxim.
Do you think those instructions need to be updated?
Well, this was not a federal instruction, and this was actually patterned after People versus Baumgartner.
So this is a state court jury instruction that was imported here for purposes of this federal offense?
This is language that was taken out of the case of People versus Baumgartner, and that instruction that the defendant did not object to, he actually asked for a supplemental instruction that added all kinds of dicta out of People versus Baumgartner that I thought was clearly inappropriate, and so did the court. But
does the government, for purposes of this offense, have to prove that the defendant was, in fact, ineligible to vote at the address that he claimed?
Yes.
Okay. So that is an element of the offense?
Yes.
And the jury was so instructed? This goes back to my first question on this.
Indirectly, Your Honor, and that's because the true issue is whether he knowingly or willfully gave false information. So whether or not it is false information, I believe the jury was entitled to know what the requirements are for a person to properly vote in the state of Illinois.
Only false if he's not eligible to vote at that residence. But the jury didn't have to find as an element of the offense that he was, in fact, ineligible. They had to find that he made these false representations.
Exactly.
Okay.
What you do each time he votes, you got to sign something or affirm that that's your residence?
Every time you go to the polls, correct.
Okay.
Because, yes. A little bit of time, I guess, on the loss methodology that so much time was spent. It's I always thought of it as a non-issue. And actually, if you read the sentencing transcript, they can't get to the point they want to get at to get below $200,000 under the sentencing guidelines. You just can't do it. A couple of reasons why, and forgetting that we established at sentencing by all relevant conduct that actually it was over $400,000, but giving all benefit of the doubt, we agreed to use a lower number of under $400,000. We have Special Agent Brad Russler testified, a previous CPA. He conducted two different search warrants at Michael Collins' residence, looked through all of business records and bank records he could find. And he testified that based upon his review of the records, an accurate tax return could not be prepared, and that's for the tax years 2002 through 2005. That's why the 20% methodology was used. Now, going back to Nancy Noonan, the defendant's expert, she admitted that since cash is fungible, she could not say that a cash deposit came from a previous check that the defendant wrote to himself or a cash withdrawal and then redeposited. That's at record 153, page 28. So she admitted that, and actually Judge Steele made a finding on the record that the defendant's claim that cash deposits made into the account came from previous withdrawals, quote-unquote, decries belief. That's document 154, page 4, lines 1 through 5. In an actual, he also determined that the defendant had committed perjury when he testified at trial, which was part of the whole reason where she had to rely much more than appellant counsel seems to indicate. She had to rely and admitted she relied on the defendant's statements as to what was a business expense or not a business expense. She further admitted that the 2005 return that she prepared, she didn't even know he had previously filed a return, didn't review what was there. She admitted that the return that she prepared was false as to the utilities in there. She admitted she made a mistake. It just goes on and on and on. But just counting the cash, if you don't withdraw the cash deposits, he's well in excess of the $200,000 for purposes of the sentencing guidelines. So it really becomes a non-issue. Her return that she prepared was not credible, so that's a non-issue. So under a clearly erroneous standard of review, I don't think it's difficult. The only other thing of somewhat concern is the sufficiency of the evidence on vote fraud. It is it's highly fact intensive. So just briefly, I can go through a couple of things. First, on March 15, 2005, federal agents knocked on the door. His room he supposedly lived in contained a portable toilet and a walker, and it didn't look like anybody lived there. That's transcript 1, page 38. And, in fact, his mother had died in 2003. She lived there up to then, and admittedly by the defendant, she had been taking care of her two grandchildren. This is a two-bedroom house. So that's all you can fit in. There are people for two bedrooms.
I didn't misunderstand that. When you said when the grandmother died, she was taking
his
care
mother.
Of...
Yes.
His mother was taking care of two children?
Two grandchildren from a different part of the family. That is correct.
Okay.
And you'll actually see that in the PSR. Secondly, he started making rent payments in 2002 to a residence in Belleville, transcript 4, page 152. Signed a loan application in October of 2003 for, actually, he built and ultimately moved in 2003 to 2004, this very nice house in Belleville. And that's transcript 2, page 129 to 132. He provided proof of residency for his child in a Belleville school, and the testimony was for proof of residency for having a child attend in that school district, you have to be a permanent resident and affirm you're a permanent resident. That's transcript 3, page 92-97. In completing the loan application, he indicated that would be his primary residence, the Belleville address, transcript 2, page 130. I mentioned the TIF application indicating the place was falling down, and that's Exhibit 403. The fact that he indicated he had never had telephone service in the East St. Louis address, that's at transcript 3, page 108. He made a recorded statement. A lady was investigating a stolen Jaguar claim. And he indicated that the Belleville address was his primary residence. He did that in 2006, transcript 3, also Government Exhibit 454.
What is the statute? Is there a statutory definition of residence for voting purposes in the state of Illinois?
If there is, as to what constitutes a residence, I don't believe it's statutory, and I believe it's case law, and I think that's where... People versus Baumgartner and Maxim come in, and all of those cases indicate two elements: physical presence and an intention to remain there permanently.
So very much in Illinois, at least, it sounds like voting residence equals domicile.
Well, and I have not seen a Illinois case address. All of these cases deal with the political candidate. I haven't seen an Illinois case deal with someone who's actually claiming and votes a full ballot as opposed to a partial ballot, and whether you can vote a full ballot when you've moved but still claim your permanent residency, if you will, is back at your prior address. But this case, it was an entire fiction, and that's what we're seeking to address. It's actually kind of become a prevalent problem, I think, part of because of the nature of the Metro East area.
Nature of what?
The Metro East area down there. Oh. And I mean, East St. Louis is not a nice place to live, and people that want to run for office down there and where there's a resident requirement would like to live elsewhere.
Is that right? So you wouldn't want to be a resident? I guess it gets back to Groucho Marx's joke, isn't it? You wouldn't want to be a member of a club that would have him as a member?
Hope I didn't go over. Thank you.
All right, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I just want to clarify that there certainly was an objection with respect to the jury instructions with respect to the election fraud issue. It wasn't an objection where we said, let's throw the whole thing out. It was an objection where we said we need to substantially modify the instruction that that the government has presented. Now, as my learned counsel, my learned colleague just informed you, the jury instructions at issue were in fact patterned after the Baumgartner case. But what I believe he's stating, to state another way, is he's cherry picked certain portions of that judicial opinion and put those into a jury instruction, and he's taken the portions that we would like to include, and he's labeled those as dicta. So he's trying to say that portions of the opinion are important, other portions are not. And I would agree 100% that in Illinois, case law defines what is a principal residence for voting purposes, and that's why the Baumgartner opinion and the language that we asked the trial court to put into the jury instruction is so important. And I think what's being lost in all of this is to compare the facts of this case to the facts of the Baumgartner case. There are a lot of similarities there. In Baumgartner, you had an individual who was claiming to reside at his father's farm. He had grown up on that farm but had left and had attended college in a remote location. He was married, had a child, was living, again, in this remote location, would go home and stay with his dad on weekends, and was running for office from his father's location. And looking at the Baumgartner opinion, I'd ask that you all revisit the facts of that case and realize that the facts of that case are very similar to this one.
Oh, it's very different. He was not residing at the East St. Louis residence in any sense of the word for a long period of time.
The Baumgartner case does a good job of defining what is residence versus abandonment. Now, going back to the first issue that I addressed today, which was the calculation of the tax loss.
Actually, you're out of time, counsel.
Your Honors.
Take the case under advisement. Thanks to both counsel.